This is WFIU, and thank you so much for listening. This is a program where we pinpoint people in the local community who make a difference in what happens in Bloomington and South Central Indiana. And we're very fortunate today to have as our guest Alon Barker. Now, I always have trouble pronouncing his first name, so if you hear it three different ways, that's not his fault. That's mine. But Alon is the executive director of the Bloomington Early Music Festival. He plays the flute. He's a percussionist. He's a musicologist. He is just one of those people who, in Bloomington, brings music alive. So thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Bob, and I'm very, very pleased to be here with you.
Okay, now I want to get a few things straight here so there's no more misunderstanding. Uh-huh. You have a French first name, a last name, and as I said earlier, no discernible area attached to it, and an accent that's difficult to pinpoint. Now, can you tell us a little bit about your history so that we can clear up all this confusion?
Sure, I'd be happy to. My first name, Alain, I guess pronounced any way you choose, comes from France, and that's because my mother's French. And she married my father in England, my father being South African, of English-Irish descent. And they went back to South Africa and decided to bring up a family and live there. And that's basically where I was born. My father's name, the Barker part of it, comes from a place in Yorkshire called Pontefract. And apparently my great-grandfather was the mayor of Pontefract, one of a bunch of lawyers who were running the town at that time. And my grandfather, deciding that there were better things to do in the colonies then in England, decided that he wanted to go to South Africa and introduced air conditioning to the country. In fact, I believe he was one of the very first people who brought air conditioning to the country. And as you can imagine, in Africa, that's a very welcome technology.
There's a band who saw an opportunity and took advantage, right?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the places that I performed one of my first concerts in Durban, which is where I was brought up, was air-conditioned by my great-grandfather. And that's something that I didn't mention to the audience at that time, but at least I was grateful that I was cooled by his technology.
Okay, so you were in Durban, South Africa. That's over on the
East Coast. I was born and partially educated in Durban. I was there until I was about 18, and then went off to university in Cape Town to do my undergraduate studies in music at the University of Cape Town, and was there for about 4 years as well. And then, as happens with a lot of young South African men, in the early 80s, there was sort of a migration to Europe for various reasons, mostly political. And I found myself in England for 2 years from about 82 to 84.
But what you say political, now you've opened up an area of interest here.
Right. Well, definitely, I think the decision that I made to move away from South Africa then had mostly to do with the political situation and more specifically to do with the obligations I had to the South African military. And I decided that rather than going to the military and being part of the system, I needed to get away. And the option that I had was to go to England or go to somewhere in Europe. And the reason, obviously, why I chose England was because I had family there and my cultural roots were partially based in England. So in a sense, it was a very natural transition for me to go to England. However difficult it felt after a while, because then I started really missing Africa and I missed a lot of what were my roots in Africa. The transition itself to London was a very natural one.
Now, there were a lot of other students who did much the same thing, I would imagine.
Right. Actually, it's quite interesting that, you know, being at the University of Cape Town from, when was it, 79 to 82, was a very important time of my life. In fact, I think that so much of what I am now, both in terms of my political outlook and my social and cultural outlook, was formed during that time. I mean, obviously, the time at home in Durban, the first 18 years of my life were very, very important too. But the time in Cape Town gave me an opportunity to really look at myself in the South African context, with the living within the apartheid system, becoming aware of what it actually meant, becoming aware of the inequities within the culture, being aware of what classical music was doing to support the system of apartheid. I mean, that was a big problem with me, and I'd like to go into that to some extent. Basically, my time in Cape Town was a time in which I became aware of who I was, what I wanted to do, and how I wanted to somehow operate in society. And a lot of my friends, feeling the same way but in different fields, fields of, say, medicine or law or education, humanities, whatever, decided that rather than leaving the country to pursue their own, you know, careers, whatever, they would want to stay in the country. And the options that they had for themselves at that time, in terms of their conscientious objection against both the military and their system of apartheid, was to go to prison or to be put in the middle of absolutely nowhere by the South African state. I have a good friend who's a doctor, and he opted for the conscientious objection route rather than going to the military, and found himself basically in the middle of the bush for 5 years working at a clinic. They needed doctors in the clinics in the rural areas of South Africa, and that's basically where he found himself for 5 years, and he wasn't allowed to go anywhere else in the country for those 5 years.
Well, did you have difficulty getting back into the country because of you going to England?
It was always very worrying for me to go back to South Africa, because essentially I had, having not gone to the military, there was the possibility that I would be, whether or not I would have actually been arrested, I don't know, but I would certainly have been spoken with and called into the military had they known that I was back in the country. And so what I did is, as soon as I went back into the country, I would register for some postgraduate degree and therefore have a reason to be in the country. That was one of the ways to get around being obliged to go into the military. So it was sort of a cat and mouse game.
Can you just touch a little bit about your father and mother? They were artistic. They are artistic.
My mother's a painter. She's an oil painter, and she's a very fine artist, I believe. Maybe that's something that's subjective, but I love her work. And being French and being very influenced by impressionistic paintings, very painterly, very beautiful, very coloristic, I think that a lot of what I am as a musician is based in what I have absorbed from her as an artist. My father is not actually a musician himself, but has always been a very staunch advocate of the arts and a very strong lover of the arts. And so I was always surrounded by different types of music, mostly classical music, really, when I was a kid. So I was able to assimilate and absorb the sense of what classical music is about, and I'm very grateful for that.
So you went to Cape Town, and your degree is in music as a flute player?
Right. Actually, I went to the University of Cape Town as a pianist, and I had picked up the flute when I was 16. And as it happens, I was able to play the flute incredibly easily, and I enjoyed playing the piano too. But I found that there were lots more opportunities for chamber music and for ensemble music and orchestral music, which I loved, with the flute. And so it was something that I naturally gravitated towards. And within a year, I had declared that as my major, and I got a degree, an undergraduate performance degree in flute at the University of Cape Town.
Then you continued to play when you went to England.
Right. I took the opportunity whilst I was in London to study with Trevor Wy, who's one of England's best teachers. He's absolutely extraordinary. And was able to play in various regional orchestras there. Well, not, you know, sort of semi-professional orchestras, not fully professional orchestras, and gigged around the place as I do and as I have done for many years. Started teaching a lot and then got into a certain amount of composition as well, I ended up writing a ballet with a colleague of mine in London at that time for a local group in London, which was then picked up by the Irish National Ballet and used as part of their permanent repertoire for about 3 years. Just one of my side little things. Having been away from South Africa for a while, for about a year and a half, I started feeling very, very homesick for the country and very homesick for a lot of the interests that I had there that, interestingly enough, I wasn't really, I mean, I was aware of, but I wasn't passionate about in the way that I became whilst I was actually living in South Africa. It's one of these things where you take something for granted and then you go away and you realize how connected you are to whatever it is, and then you want to go back to that thing, and that thing was African music. And my sense of being very in my blood connected to Africa and to the African music and to the African environment and the beauty of the place. And so I really wanted to go back and learn more about my roots and learn more about African music. And so I chose to go back to South Africa in 1984 to do a lot of work in ethnomusicology, to do a lot of work in African musical styles, Learned from a lot of musicians who were working at that time, mostly out of university departments, university music departments.
Let's take a little break and listen to some music. And then I'd like to come back and touch on some of the other places you played as a classical player and then really hit in on the African music, if we could.
That sounds good.
Okay, what would you like to, what did you bring as a selection for today?
Well, actually, I'm thinking since I'm talking about Africa, it might be good to introduce an African excerpt at this point. What I've chosen to bring is a piece of music by a group that I don't know. When I was young, I used to pick up lots of tapes all over the place, and this is one of this is a recording that I absolutely love to dance with. And the reason why I'm bringing it to you is because it sounds very much like the type of music that you would hear being piped through a bazaar in the middle of Durban, you know, a street with lots of different shops and music blaring all over the place and the heat of Africa and sometimes people dancing in the streets or, you know, just being on, you know, buying their clothes or buying their food and bustling around. And there's something about this excerpt that really gives me that sense of being back in my hometown, Durban.
Well, let's listen to it. Then maybe we can talk about it right after it's over.
Sure.
We have just heard a special selection of African music, a selection made by our guest, Alan Barker, who is not only a flute player, but a specialist in African music. And can you just touch one more time about what it is about the African music that you find so unique?
Right. There are two things about African music. There are two types of African music, I guess I could say, that I find really very, very interesting and stimulating and exciting. The one is the more traditional styles, of which there are many, many styles. And the other is the fusion that has come about, through the century pretty much through the century in African music that has now become very much part of traditional African music. So when people talk about traditional African music, sometimes I'm not sure exactly what they mean. The old African styles that I love are beautiful because they approach music in a way that is so utterly different to our concept of what music is in our lives. These older traditional styles, there I go using that word again, but these older styles are so intimately and inextricably connected to their sense of being, their sense of place, the activities that take place in their community during the week, during the day, during various festival seasons.
I hate to get off this, but we still have a lot to cover here. And you went back to South Africa, but now you're in Bloomington.
Now I'm in Bloomington.
I think I'd like to – how did you get here?
I came here in the fall of 86. And if you want me to be honest about it, I came here because I was having a relationship with a very dear friend of mine who was studying here in Bloomington, and she decided that it was important for her to be here for a while, and I wanted to be with her. And I heard about the IU School of Music, and I heard about how wonderful it was in Bloomington, and essentially just followed the opportunity that made itself available to me and came here initially as a graduate student in the School of Music, but working for the folklore department, working in the archives of traditional music. And I was brought here to build instruments, to build African instruments, and to teach some of the instrumental styles that I had picked up whilst I was back in South Africa during that time. And my interests in being in Bloomington really had to do with developing my skills as a flute player and developing my knowledge in classical music. And so that's why I did a master's and then studying for a doctorate in the School of Music.
But you had heard about Indiana University in Cape Town or Durban,
in Durban,
South Africa.
That's right.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And that's before internet, too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
But then there was a little hiatus where you went to Spain.
In 91, I went to Spain for a year to play in an orchestra there, to play in Asturias, which is a principality, a northern region of Spain.
This is the flute.
The flute.
Yes.
And I was playing co-principal flute in the Asturian orchestra in Oviedo in Spain. And I just spent a year there having a really wonderful time playing in the orchestra, learning a lot of repertoire, working with some wonderful conductors. The music director at that time was somebody called Jesse Levine, who comes out of Yale. He's actually a violist and an American conductor who was working there at that time.
Didn't you have some problems with your playing while you were there?
Yeah, that's actually part of the reason why I left Spain at the end of the year, is that towards the end of the season I took a break. I went back home to South Africa for about 3 weeks, did all those things that I never tell my students to do, didn't practice, went back to Spain, didn't prepare one of the big programs that we were performing the week after I got there, and was working very hard and preparing the program, and found myself getting more and more tense. My muscles got more and more tense. You know, playing a musical instrument is very much like an athletic activity, and if you haven't kept yourself up in good physical shape, you can do yourself some serious damage. And as it happens, I was just warming up one morning, and one of the muscles in my left forearm went into sort of a spasm and tore away slightly from the tendons, the filaments of the tendons that connect with the muscle. And I got a whole lot of scar tissue in my muscle and literally had to stop playing for about 5 years.
Really? That long?
Right. It takes a very long time for scar tissue in the muscle to heal.
But you're back?
I'm getting back to it now. I've been playing on and off for about a year, and it feels like it's really getting back together again, and I'm very excited about spending more and more time with the flute and doing the sorts of things that I love doing with the instrument.
What else have you brought for us?
I have one of my most favorite recordings coming out of the St. Matthew Passion. It's a recording done by John Elliott Gardiner with the English Baroque soloists, and it's halfway through the St. Matthew Passion. There's the most beautiful aria called Erbarme Dich and Erbarme Dich, which is just absolutely extraordinary. I feel the violin playing on this recording is absolutely beautiful. And for me, it encapsulates so much of what I love about Bach, what I love about the way that he paints words, and also the way that I appreciate performance practice, people who've looked at the historical elements in performance practice and have now develop their styles and abilities to the point where they create these sorts of recordings.
Well, let's hear this. We have just heard an excerpt from Bach's St. Matthew Passion with the orchestra conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. It was a selection by our guest, Alon Barker. You want to just touch again why it was so important to you?
The actual recording itself? Mm-hmm. Because first of all, it's sublimely beautiful. I think that the violin playing and the singing, the countertenor singing on this recording is just heavenly. And through the years, it's interesting, a lot of my appreciation of performances have to do with both the music as well as the technique and instrumental playing itself. Being an instrumentalist myself, I often find myself fixating on just the simple beauty of somebody's playing. And I think that this recording encapsulates that as well. The sort of thing that I love about Baroque violin playing when it's done as well as it's done in this recording. The other thing that's important about this recording, I guess, is the time that I spent in Spain was a very difficult time in some ways for me. My decision to go to Spain was made within a week, and I didn't know a word of Spanish when I got there. And so for a good month and a half, I was listening to an enormous amount of music and just keeping myself going with recordings. And this was one of the recordings that I would listen to a lot of the time. And so it has a very special place in my heart.
It has a personal meaning, but doesn't the whole Baroque era have something to you? That's where the passion to develop the Bloomington Early Music Festival came from.
You know, my interest in Baroque music has always been there. But I don't really consider myself a specialist as such in early music. I think that my interest in the Bloomington Early Music Festival developed because of the opportunity that it gave me to develop a festival that I thought would be meaningful in a number of different ways. I've felt that the way that classical music is performed, presented, promoted, the way that people either have access to it or don't have access to it, you know, worried me. I felt that there was so much in classical music that was so meaningful to me, and I felt that there was a problem in classical music's ability to reveal itself to the society at large. And if I could just backtrack very briefly, I think that the roots of my feelings about the way that classical music was, in a sense, going down the wrong path, came out of South Africa and came out of this microcosm of European culture in a foreign country. Essentially, classical music was being used by the state in South Africa to culturally legitimize the system of apartheid and the system of European cultural and economic domination in the country. And I think that even though one has to be very careful not to make any direct parallels, of course, Europe and America are utterly different environments. Europe is where classical music originated, and America has a much more authentic connection with classical music. There are still some very striking parallels between what I was experiencing in South Africa and what I came to experience here in the States. I think that for decades, classical music has been seen and has operated and has functioned as part of the establishment, as part of the political establishment. Funding of the arts has generally gone towards classical music, if it's in music, and other types of music have essentially had to fend for themselves, and I don't think that that's right or appropriate. And so what I've attempted to do in this festival, and what I would love to spend doing for the rest of my life, really, is to work out ways for classical music to be really what it is in our culture, and that is human beings producing the most beautiful art that has a lot of meaning to their lives, that has a lot of meaning to other people's lives, and in a sense reveal classical music for what it is rather than for the way that it has been presented and used in the past.
Well, how do you take these ideas and make the commonplace of classical music presentation unusual in the Blimp Festival?
I think it has to do with presentation as much as it has to do with content. I think, you know, some people have said to me, well, you know, in the end, what really is different between a performance, say, at the Bloomington Early Music Festival and a performance that happens in some traditional setting, you know, that is considered to be alienated or separated from the rest of society? And in the end, there isn't much of a difference if the performances within those contexts are really meaningful and beautiful. I think what the Bloomington Early Music Festival does differently is it attempts to communicate very actively with a broad spectrum in the community. If you look at our logo, for instance, the graphic that we use, Bach standing in a cornfield next to a sign that says Leipzig, Bloomington, and Tucson. Tucson, by the way, is just a random name. I don't think that it means anything. It's an attempt to say, you know, classical music can also be down home. Classical music can also be as much a part of our lives as other types of music that we listen to every day. And it doesn't have to be put up on a pedestal. It doesn't have to be separated off from what we consider to be important in our lives. And I think that's really what we're trying to do with the Bloomington Early Music Festival.
Now, for example, if someone, though, says, I know that stuff. It's a bunch of folks standing around playing out-of-tune instruments along with a harpsichord. And I don't really like that stuff. What do you have to offer for someone that doesn't specifically like Baroque or
right.
early music?
Right. Well, if you look at the festival that we're doing this year, we're actually presenting a lot of different types of music, not just what is usually considered to be early music, you know, people in sandals playing, you know, out-of-tune instruments and things, which I don't accept. I think that's a very unfair and bad misrepresentation.
Well, I was trying to make an example.
Yes. But I think that, for instance, one of the big concerts that we're doing this year, we're leading our festival with this performance by Malcolm Dalglish, the Ulites, and a new dance group called Tongue and Groove, all of whom are members of our wonderful community here in Bloomington. And I'm very excited about this because I think that early music can be cross-cultural. It can also relate to other types of music than what is normally considered to be classical music. And so here we have a folk music concert, which is deeply rooted in its own sense of history, in its own sense of performance practice, in its own tradition of performance practice. And so when I talk about early music, I actually talk about lots of different types of music that have historical roots that are performed and thought about in terms of the traditions that they come from, the historical performance practice that is part of that music. Other years in the festival, we've had Ghanaian drumming, we've had Irish fiddling, we've had Hindustani music. So not to say that those are core elements of the festival, they're just elements within the festival to mix up a concept of what early music is. We also love the more traditional concepts of early music, obviously, and the bulk of what we're performing this year are what people would normally consider to be early music.
I'd like to have a little more music, and then I have a few questions to ask before we end. Anything? What else did you bring?
Well, here's another example of a good look at the history of Western art music. This is a recording of Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, done by another one of our leaders in the field called Roger Norrington and the London Classical Players, a wonderful group in London, coming out of London, they've done some really extraordinary recordings. They've done a lot of really great Beethoven symphonies. And I wanted to bring this because, you know, the minute music becomes predictable, it becomes staid and boring. And this is an example of an experiment that I think works extremely well. Some people have criticized this recording because they feel that it doesn't encapsulate a lot of the affect or a lot of the intensity of the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique. But I believe that it really does. And I'd just like to offer this as an example of a recording that I really love. I'm going to choose The Ball, the waltz, from the Symphonie Fantastique, performed by the London Classical Players.
With Roger Norrington.
With Roger Norrington directing.
We have just heard the waltz, the ball section, from Symphonie Fantastique of Hector Berlioz, played by the London Classical Players, conducted by Roger Norrington. It was a selection made by our guest today, Alain Barker, the executive director of the Bloomington Early Music Festival, a flutist, ethnomusicologist, and seems to be and promoter around here in this community. Alain, before we end, I'd like to ask you one question that maybe with your experience that you've had since you've been here, you can maybe amplify on a little bit. Do you see any artistic needs for Bloomington and the South Central Indiana area that are not being met, that artistically are being overlooked?
That's a big question. I think. Well, I guess what I'd like to say to begin with is that, as I'm sure many, many people, most people in this community feel, it's an incredible environment. It's really one of the most extraordinary environments I've ever been in. And I'm very excited that it is flourishing and growing and developing in the way that it is. I think that if there was anything that I would like to see for Bloomington and South Central Indiana in general, I would like to see a more active communication between those people, say, for instance, at Indiana University who are doing such incredible things, and people in the community as well as, you know, more direct outreach to communities in the region itself. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Alan. It's been wonderful. I've enjoyed hearing you play. I've enjoyed seeing what you've created over at BLEMF, and I've really welcomed the opportunity to get to know you even more.
Thank you. Even better,
I suppose.
It's my pleasure to be on this program.
So thank you very much. As we leave, you have one further selection you'd like for us to play.
The excerpt that I have here is by Johann Heinrich Schmelzer, one of his sonatas, performed by an extraordinary violinist, Andrew Manzi.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in May of 1998. Production assistance came from Mike Pashkash and Christina Kuzmich. For WFIU, thanks for listening.